Good morning. Today is Wednesday, December 11th, 2024. This is a special meeting of the Building Inspection Commission. I would like to remind everyone to please mute yourself if you're not speaking. The first item on the agenda is roll call. President Alexander Tuke.
Here.
Vice President Shaddix.
Here.
Commissioner Ming.
Here.
Commissioner Williams.
Here.
We have a quorum, and Commissioner Chavez is expected, and Commissioner Newman is excused. Next, we have our land acknowledgement.
The Building Inspection Commission acknowledges that we are on the unceded ancestral homeland of the Ramaytush Ohlone, who are the original inhabitants of the San Francisco Peninsula. As the indigenous stewards of this land and in accordance with their tradition, the Ramaytush Ohlone have never ceded, lost, nor forgotten their responsibilities as the caretakers of this place, as well as for all peoples who reside in their traditional territory. As guests, we recognize that we benefit from living and working on the traditional homeland. We wish to pay our respects by acknowledging the ancestors, elders, and relatives of the Ramaytush Ohlone community and by affirming their sovereign rights as First Peoples.
Thank you. Next, for any members of the public that may be listening in, the public comment call-in number is 415-655-0001. Access code is 2663-539-9899. Okay. And next we have item two, President opening remarks.
Good morning, commissioners, Director Reardon, members of the public. Congratulations on the end of a big year. We've had a lot of accomplishments this year, and it can only be with the partnership of our staff leadership, and our commission together working towards common goals. And I just wanted to highlight some of the things that I think are of particular note this year. And one of them is we accomplished the fee study. We have established the fee study to stabilize our finances and created a policy path forward to be able to increase those fees over time. And that's a very significant policy change that took both political will and foresight on the path of the department. So congratulations and thank you to everyone on that. And then, of course, we continue to increase our approval rates and permits and streamline the permitting process. And then finally, we have implemented all of the controller's recommendations and got a glowing report from the controller's office on our ethical standards. And that is something that took an incredible amount of work and and so I just want to recognize all of that. That is a big accomplishment this year, and congratulations to everybody. And then, as we do, we continue the basic work every day of keeping San Franciscans safe in their houses, in their homes, in their apartment buildings, in their SROs, and in their places of work, and on the streets where they are walking by those buildings. So the day-to-day work continues to be really important and a focus for the department. And I just want to take the time to recognize that at the end of the year. So congratulations on all of that, everybody, and to commissioners, and Happy New Year. That's
all. Thank you. Is there any public comment on the president's opening remarks? Seeing none, we are on item three, general public comment. The BIC will take public comment on matters within the commission's jurisdiction that are not part of this agenda.
Good morning, I have a handout. The time is set for 10 minutes. I don't need 10 minutes.
I'll reset that just a moment.
It would be nice, but inappropriate. If I have a computer presentation.
Okay.
I'm ready, thank you. DBI twice created false complaints after valid complaints were filed against Susan McCormick Taylor building permits, once for a foundation repair permit and a second time for a bedroom and bath remodel permit. DBI also improperly closed two complaints for submitting building permits with plans that misrepresent the number and location of the existing ground floor garage windows. This table is from the building code, and it shows the period of time that's allowed for a building permit before it expires based on the value of the permit. A foundation repair permit complaint was opened 78 days ago. It should have been closed. Senior Inspector Mauricio Hernandez approved a foundation special inspection 404 days after the foundation repair permit was null and void, and the foundation special inspection was approved without a final affidavit from the architect. The complaint is being researched by Inspector Gilbert Lamb. A second foundation repair complaint was opened 1 month after the first complaint. The second complaint was opened by Inspector Saunders, who received the first complaint. We have two open foundation repair complaints. An expired bedroom and bath remodel complaint was improperly closed by Inspector Saunders 7 days after it was open. Inspector Saunders approved an extension of a building permit that had been null and void for 127 days. Inspector Saunders failed to sign the building permit extension. A second bedroom and bath remodel complaint was opened 40 days after the first complaint was closed by Inspector Saunders. This complaint is under review by Inspector Saunders, who closed the first complaint. Two Susan McCormick Taylor building permits were submitted with architectural plans which misrepresent the number and location of the ground floor windows in the picture below. In the picture below, you can see there's a red wheelbarrow. There's a window behind the wheelbarrow. There's a window to the left of the wheelbarrow. There are only two windows. The window above the red wheelbarrow is missing from the plans. The window to the left of the red wheelbarrow is two windows in the plan. And a window was inserted in the plans on the wall with the electrical boxes. That's behind the blue tub. Here's the plans. You can see they're wrong. Two complaints for inaccurate architectural plans were closed, improperly closed. This is not good. This stuff needs to end. Thank you.
Is there any additional public comment?
Oops, the little thingy fell off. Does that matter?
Can you pick it up? I haven't started your time.
Okay, I want to pause my time.
I haven't started.
I've got germ stuff. I don't want to touch it. Thank you, Sonia.
Where is it?
Right there. Thank you, Sonia. Okay, I'd like to talk about the hiring process. When O'Riordan and I were hired, I was hired before him, and I scored higher on the test. We had three outside people from different jurisdictions doing the hiring. Now it's all inside. It appears to be, kind of the good old boys club. And this is the announcement. O'Riordan talks about Kevin Birmingham keeps projects moving along. You never want to fail an inspection, even if it's not per code. Okay, and then we have Mauricio Hernandez here, and another Mark Walls. These were, an article was in Mission Local on this, I will be referring to that. And Mauricio Hernandez, who was named in a lawsuit by Dennis Richards. You could see that online, Mission Local. Dennis Richards, if you Google that. That was settled in a favor for $1.8 million for the plaintiff, costing the city. Here's another article called Bringing Down the House. It was in the, whatever it says up there, the SF Weekly. I believe this is also by the Joe Escanubo, whatever. And this is about where Matt Green went out of his district into my district and missed the shoring of the building. It was supposed to, I believe, have around 9 shoring. This is a Santos, Coran, Bernie, and Matt Green were all on this as they were on other projects working together. The building went down the hill because of the failed shoring. Matt Green went out there several times for his friend who was helping him out after he got in a little situation in Golden Gate Park, which he alludes to in the Dennis Richards case. There was nothing left of the building. They were supposed to keep it. Big tarp was put over. It was completely demolished. Here's another one, naming the city families okaying their own family jobs. Joe Eskenazi, Mission Local, January 8th. This is how the old test worked. You could see O'Riordan came in here at number 13, right in the middle. And then he told me before we used to commute together that Sweeney gave him the answers to the test. And he forgot one of them. And one of the answers was, or one of the questions was, what do you do with an employee who is not performing right? He said, you kind of counsel him or something like that. He told me Sweeney had to write it down on a piece of paper and shove it over for him to read. He goes, no, you need, and it said, you need to document everything. Here's the score he got on that test. Overhead, please.
You can wrap up your comments, sir.
I'm wrapping it up.
The timer's up, so you can say your last
comment. Oh, it's up. Okay. Mm-hmm. Last, the sprinklers are all abated on 2 Rousseau and 6 Rousseau and 3030 California by newly appointed permanent Chief Hernandez. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any additional public comment? Okay, I'm seeing none. We're on to item 4, update on the Access Appeals Commission and an overview regarding the appeal process.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mary Wilkinson Church, Department of Building Inspection. We do have a PowerPoint to go along with this. Okay. So the Access Appeals Commission was established by the San Francisco Building Code, Section 105.3. The Access Appeals Commission hears appeals of DBI decisions on the enforcement of disabled access and the adaptability provisions of the code. The commission may also make determinations on code equivalencies, technical infeasibility, and unreasonable hardship, as well as time extensions. The committee is comprised of 5 members, each with a 4-year term. 2 members do have a physical disability. 2 members are with the construction industry, and 1 member is of the general public. So the background for the Accessible Business Entrance Program is that it was established by city ordinance in 2016, and it's administered by the Department of Building Inspection. The program requires places of public accommodation to have all primary entries and paths of travel into a building be accessible by persons with disabilities. The ABE program has 4 building categories indicating the barriers of disability access. The primary entry, the first category is that the primary entry already complies. The second category is that there are no steps to the primary entry, and 1 or more of elements to the entry do not comply with the requirements for accessibility. Category 3, there is a step to the primary entry, and one or more elements of the entry do not comply with the requirements for accessibility. And then, of course, Category 4 is that the building has a primary entry with more than one steps, and the elements of the entry do not comply with code requirements. So the role of the Access Appeals Commission within the ABE program: buildings subject to the program can file for exemptions and claiming for requesting equivalencies for facilitation, technical infeasibility, or unreasonable hardship as defined in SFBC 1105D.1 through 1105D.3. The Access Appeals Commission is involved in all exemption pathways, including setting the standards for equivalent facilitation, ratifying non-structural technical infeasibility claims, and determining financial hardships. So the Access Appeals Commission must ratify all unreasonable hardship request approvals in San Francisco. So what we really wanted to get to today in this presentation for you is the actual process for unreasonable hardship requests. This was kind of brought up in the last meeting, and additional information was requested by yourselves, and so we're here to talk about that today. So the process for unreasonable hardship requests is, one, hire a certified access appeals specialist, architect, or engineer to conduct an evaluation and prepare the disabled access compliance checklist. Two, the CASP inspector or architect or engineer submits that checklist and an unreasonable hardship exemption form. They then prepare and submit for a building permit application, cost estimates, and construction plans, and to make the primary entrance accessible, as well as affordable alternatives that may meet the spirit of the code. So the fourth step then would be that our intake staff, DBI intake staff, or the permit center confirms the application and submission and verifies that all the materials are complete for the submission. DBI accepts the permit application. We conduct a plan review and we provide comments pertaining to the review to the design professional. The architect, engineer, or designer revise and then resubmit the application and plans based upon those comments. The permit is approved by each relevant permitting department, such as DBI, planning, the fire department, or any other departments that may have a part in the plan review based on the building type and occupancy. And then DBI evaluates the unreasonable hardship supporting information and alternative accessibility methods, or they approve or deny the request. They then inform the applicant of that decision. The applicant then comes back and submits the unreasonable hardship application or appeal and supporting documentation to the Access Appeals Commission, and then they pay the appeal fee. The Access Appeals Commission secretary works with the design professional to verify their proposed accessibility improvements are readily achievable and that the financial information and cost estimates that they've provided as part of their appeal are accurate. The item is put on the AAC agenda and a hearing is conducted where members may identify additional code alternatives to increase access. The design professional may need to revise plans to include any requirements to ratification. The Access Appeal Commission members vote to ratify or deny the unreasonable hardship request or appeal. And then, if necessary, the plans are resubmitted and evaluated in plan review. Comments are issued and revisions may be required at that point based on any equivalencies that the Access Appeals Commission found. And once approved, the applicant pays their final fees, the permits are issued, and work may commence. So the number of current unreasonable hardship requests that we have seen come through. So first, there are 23,522 buildings that are actually within the ABE program. 19,584 buildings, or 83% of these buildings, have started or completed the compliance process. 404 buildings, so 1.7% of the buildings that are in the program, have completed the compliance checklist and indicated on that checklist that they would like to, that they are noting an unreasonable hardship. But of those, 137 have applied for a permit, so 0.6% of those buildings have applied for a permit, and 14 have included unreasonable hardship as part of their application in their scope of work. So of the buildings that we have, or the permits that we have seen come through in the program, in 14 of those permit applications, we have actually seen that someone has requested an unreasonable hardship as part of the program. And that's all we have as far as an update.
Thank you. Is there any public comment on the item? You can have a seat, and we'll do the question and answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Walter Park. I'm a member of the Access Appeals Commission. I wrote the ordinance that created the Access Appeals Commission in the mid-1980s. Was carried by Harry Britt, was signed at the board by President John Molinari, was approved as to form by the city attorney, and was signed by the mayor. We are scheduled to have two meetings a month because we have often needed to have two meetings a month. The building department, I'd like to show this. This is the three pages of their PowerPoint, just made into one list of 14 points. I think they're trying to make this sound incredibly complex, and in fact, to make it incredibly complex and difficult to deal with. I pity the fact that the building department is stuck with such an onerous system that doesn't work for anybody. But who designed that onerous system? The building department did. This works well, perhaps, for the Bank of America, for Millennium Tower, for the Transbay Terminal. It doesn't work well for a nail salon that's got a 500-foot square foot space. We don't need all of that. We don't need all of those professionals. We don't need all of that review. Some of the people who testified before and I are talking with Supervisor Mandelman, and we're going to propose 7 or 8 changes to this. We want to get rid of half of these for sure so that this system can work. Let me point out one other thing. And that is, you keep hearing this 82% success rate. Wait a minute. That's based on 16,777 cases. But of those, 11,800 are either exempt or waived. So no access was provided there. So the real universe is not 23,000, it's half of 23,000. That changes all these numbers. It changes the success rate, and it changes the scale of the problem, because half of the cases were categorically dispensed with. Then if you look at the number of compliant cases, the total number, instead of 16,777, then is 5,120, because we're going to subtract the 11,000. So the compliant cases are 5120. The non-compliant cases are 6749 out of that 11-some thousand. So it's about 50% compliant and about 50% non-compliant, truly. I also want to point out that the building department seems to have a hostility toward the Access Appeals Commission, which I don't understand. All the delays happen in the staff section of the process, which they've designed and they implement. No delays happen because of the commission. And I point out the fact that although you're having a hearing on the Access Appeals Commission, our secretary did not inform us of this hearing, and none of you invited us. but we're happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any additional public comment? Okay, seeing none, the commissioners have any questions of staff?
Yeah, I need a minute.
Okay, take a minute. I have a question. Could for the members of the Access Appeals Board, could you talk about what is your scope and what kind of some historical context for what has come before you in addition to just this legislation, but what else? What else comes before you?
We have a special scope. That is, we only deal with accessibility questions. Other questions go to Board of Permit Appeals or to you. And we have a specialty. So that's why we have two designated members, or people with disabilities, two designated members who are from the construction industry. There is no other commission in the city that I know of that has designated disabled members. We're the only one that has to have disability input for obvious reasons. What we hear are appeals from any decision of the building department that relate to accessibility. So if an inspector decides that something is okay, is permittable, and a disabled person says, oh, I can't use it, I don't think it complies, they could theoretically appeal to us. It has never happened. What has happened is the owners and the tenants appeal to us over and over and over. And so we're starting with a building department decision and then trying to make something work that's less expensive and that the person can deal with as a reasonable accommodation, not as an unreasonable accommodation. So our scope is all of that. Why there are 404 cases listed here that are where someone said, I want an unreasonable hardship determination, and we've only had two cases, I don't know. I'll also point out that if 404 people put that on the form, I'll bet there are another 800 who did not put it on the form. These forms are complex and difficult, and people have been discouraged, obviously, from coming to us because we seem to be short 402 cases.
Thank you. And then you talked about this process that you laid out for this particular piece of legislation being more cumbersome. Do you have examples or of other of less stringent what are the processes that came before you before that maybe didn't require as many professionals being involved? Are there other processes that you think that could be replicated?
Well, our bylaws don't require any professional input. An owner or a tenant can simply appear before us and bring handwritten drawings and testify on their own behalf. And sometimes that's very effective because a one person who owns a two-person shop that's 500 square feet is pretty hard to say no to. Whereas their lawyer or their architect or their CASP, that's a professional, and we like to argue with them a little more. So our requirement is not that we have all of this, and I'd like to see where we can pull that back. I mean, we have other suggestions, too. I didn't go through them with you because you've already made your decision. So now we're trying to talk with the board about making changes. And I believe they will because we're engaged in useful discussions.
Could you email your bylaws to the commission secretary, or do we have a copy of those bylaws?
I believe we do.
Could you provide those to the commission?
Okay.
Other questions?
Yeah, I'm ready now for the gentleman. Question for you. So, you know, I'm on a particular corridor often, and we have a lot of those nail salons you refer to and those beauty salons that are 400, 500 square feet. Many of them have one step up. You know, when they built a transit line down the corridor, I don't know why they didn't level up the whole sidewalks. They didn't, but, you know, another story for another day. A lot of these small businesses, they're just not going to, you know, they're just hoping nobody's going to rat them out or nobody's going to be, you know, the drive-bys and stuff. what I did, and I worked with, I think, several people through DBI, is to get information out to these small businesses that, you know, you had to get a CASP inspection. That was like, everybody said you had to get a CASP inspection. That's just what we were told. And that's what I told everybody, is you had to get a CASP inspection. Many didn't, because they saw they had to pay. We did have a grant program at one time where we covered up to like 10 people, but there were still far more than 10. The problem, or not the challenge now that I'm hearing, is that you're right. On that CASP inspection, I don't ever remember seeing anything about an opportunity to appeal or an opportunity to, you know, have your not day in court, if you will. I mean, who wants to, you know, if you've got two steps leading up to your doorway and you know that you, the nail salon owner, and I've worked on some of these projects. I mean, they can run north of $25,000 up to $100,000 to get that, you know, sidewalk level. They're not going to, you know, they're not motivated to try to fix the issue. The landlord's not going to do it unless, you know, they're compelled to do it. So I guess what I'm getting at is, where did we miss, you know, from the CASP inspection that I was asking everyone to fill out? Not everybody did. What did we miss? I'm like, I mean, you're telling me this is a, the way I'm hearing this was a much simpler process than what we were rolling out to the small businesses. And I feel like I missed something here, that I have to go back to these, some of these businesses, and say, hey, you still, and tell me if I'm wrong, you still have to get a CASP inspection, no matter what. You have to have a CASP. It all starts with that CASP, and then, and it goes from there.
Well, the code actually says it can be a licensed professional. It can be an architect, an engineer, or a CASP, or a certified CASP. and I don't know which is cheaper or easier to do. Our most recent case, which is now many months ago, was a place where the appellant said, well, to fix the sidewalk, we'd have to spend $70,000. Oh. And we said, don't fix the sidewalk. It's very simple. They improved the doorway, they made some other improvements, and we just said, don't do that. One advantage of the Appeals Commission is the law is a blunt instrument. It's all black and white, and you can't change it from minute to minute. We're an appeals body. We hear individual cases. And we have somebody say, $70,000 is out of our range. It'll never happen. We said, right, don't do it, but do these things. And so they improved the doorway, but they did not do the sidewalk work. The biggest impediment here probably is Public Works. Public Works is pretty rigid about preserving the public right-of-way exactly as it exists, and it's very expensive to do that, especially if you have a, if you're a private owner. You're responsible for your sidewalk, but you don't, it's, the city has the right. And we've had case after case where we have gone months with Public Works. And I think one of the things we're going to suggest is some way to reduce that whole sidewalk condition and either move the responsibility to the city, who may choose not to fix it, or in some other way reduce the role of Public Works, because Public Works, I mean, I understand what they're trying to do, and it works great if you're the Bank of America, but it doesn't work very well if you're running a nail salon. And that's the biggest change that probably we would have happen, is to reduce the role of Public Works. Planning also, there are many steps just in the planning department review, and I don't quite understand that either. I think both of those could be collapsed somewhat.
Okay. I just, my last comment is I just wish this could be maybe repackaged and reintroduced to the business owners that have not complied. I think most that haven't, I, my opinion, that most that haven't complied just are hoping that nobody notices that they, you know, and I don't blame them, because I have personally seen that $70,000 sidewalk repair, and I've seen the $30,000 front entrance doorwell, you know, expanded. And I think most are just hoping that they don't get, you know, and we've had the drive-by, you know, we've had all that, the drive-by lawsuits, we've had it. So I just kind of wish there was another way to repackage this without all the, as you say, all the terms and all the conditions and the regulations and all the things you need, the processes that you need to do. Maybe there's just something simple as to just, you know, get the inspection and then go right to you. So I'll stop there. I appreciate you a lot. I thank you.
There is. The go ahead.
So I guess my question in my thinking, and the reason that I had concerns about the structure of this legislation, and I think that the stats that 2/3 of the ones who are considered compliant are exempt or waived proves kind of the point that this is an expensive, well, let's presume that the last 15%, 10% are exempt or waived, and 5%, you know, will have to come into some kind of compliance. And maybe it's a bigger percentage. I'm just wondering, like, is it better to just have categorical exemptions? Like, if you're this size, then you are exempt because you're probably going to be exempt anyways based on our understanding of 2/3 of the people who have gone through the process are already exempt. It just seems like it's an expensive mandate when most, a clear majority are exempt. And I'm wondering if you have thinking based on your understanding of, you know, who are you almost guaranteed to exempt? Can we put that into the legislation and then focus on the folks who really need to come into compliance? Because I do think it's an expensive burden if we know that the clear majority have to just come in and prove that they're exempt or are going to be waived.
Let me point out that the female architect who testified before you at the last meeting, came up to us during the break and said, I was never told that I could apply for an unreasonable accommodation. So she had this great complaint to you, and as soon as she heard that we existed and what we do, she said, oh, I was never informed of that. So right away, the process just is broken. It just doesn't work at all. Coming up with categories that are sort of sub-accessible is obviously a touchy thing to do, and I think that's to be discussed. You know, how we would handle sidewalks exactly is important. How to handle a power door when there's no side strike clearance, we need to discuss. If we simply said any business under 500 square feet is exempt, there are probably times when they could make it accessible by spending a few hundred dollars, and so I hate to give those up. I'd like to actually look at some cases. What we haven't done is see any cases. And the ones that have been waivered or the ones that have applied for unreasonable hardship, I'd like to do a little spot check of those and say, okay, what are the problems? And can we find some sort of categorical way to reduce that? The other thing is that the city could provide more help. You know, we are, as Henry Kornilowitz pointed out, we're the only city that's doing this. And he said, therefore, that's bad. And I'm saying, therefore, that's great, because San Francisco's always been a leader. We always do this stuff first. If we make it work, other cities will then make it work. If we let it fail, it dies. The city's going to hire a CASP, right? What if you have that CASP available to people who need some consulting, who have drawings and photographs, and they say, how big a job is this? Couldn't a city person help them to do that? Also, OSB has this $10,000 grant. I don't know how much was in the fund, but I'm reading it. I noticed that the grant is only available to it is not available to owners. It's available to the tenant, the business operator. But Arnie testified last time that of the 197 cases he's worked on, the vast majority were being handled by the owner. So your loan program doesn't apply to the very people who would benefit from it. Now, I understand they own a building, they have real property, and so maybe there's some reason to stay away from them. But I'd say, no, that's wrong. Many of these are also small property owners. I'd love to give you some more detail as it develops and see what we can come up with.
Mr. Williams.
So earlier you stated of the steps in the process, you would eliminate half of them. Identify which steps you'd eliminate?
No, I don't think I should. Part of it is technical. How much can we get 80% of the information with 20% of the effort, or with 75% of the effort? I'd be happy with. But it's also very political. The public works is not going to want to hear us say, forget about sidewalks so on. So that's, yeah, we'll write them down. We'll make it possible for everybody to discuss them. But right now, I don't want to come to any conclusions about it.
I'm curious what the relationship is between the determinations made by your board and then the federal ADA law. If you all grant an unreasonable hardship, or you come up with sort of equivalent accessibility, would the small business still be at risk to like a civil, like federal lawsuit, though?
No matter what we do, that's the case. The building department does not enforce the ADA. Mm-hmm. The building department enforces the building code.
So then wouldn't small businesses be lulled into a sense of like, oh, we're safe, but they're still at risk, right?
The way the federal law is written, it's not really enforced locally by people like you.
Right.
It relies on the right of private action. And so a disabled person can file a lawsuit. So then we get, at some point, somebody realizes we can make an industry out of this by driving by and just sending a letter and getting $10,000 cash with no remedy. They don't require that it be fixed. They just require they get the $10,000. So that's horrendous.
Yeah.
On the other hand, a disabled person who lives in the neighborhood probably is never going to try to go through the complaint process because they don't know how it would work. But inherent in Katie's original law is that we cannot absolutely protect people from an ADA lawsuit because we don't control that. Mm-hmm. What we can do is say that you have made good faith efforts to provide accessibility. And when you are hearing an ADA case, the federal courts take into consideration good faith efforts. Most people make no efforts whatsoever, and that's why they get sued. In this case, they can say, well, I got a certification from the city that says I'm good enough given my size. And should they be sued, I think that's a defense. But no, there's no absolute defense because of this.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just make a comment that in general, I'm very supportive of the idea, especially for folks who are going to get a waiver or an exemption, that there is some kind of other good faith effort, right? Like I would love to see an amendment or changes that improve accessibility in some way or another. And you gave many examples at the last hearing. Those have definitely stuck with me. So thank you for those examples. I think the department can do a better job of informing people that this exists. It's a difficult thing for the department enforces black and white law rules, and then there's an appeals board that has has more discretion. But I think that we can think about working with the department on educational efforts. But I think the idea, like the policy, I think can be hopefully amended if that's where you guys are going with to really kind of reflect the full, like your team's full thinking about what is accessibility and build those things in so that folks aren't, like small businesses aren't spending tens of thousands of dollars just to get a waiver signed, right? Like that's, I don't think anyone thinks that's a good process. And I appreciate your kind of seeing both sides of this issue and wanting to make it smoother for small business owners.
Almost never do we tell an appellant, okay, just go home. We always get some access out of it. We always
right.
improve the level of access. And let me also remind you, access does not trigger access. So if you get a permit to change the bathroom, you may have to do the path of travel. But if you get a permit to fix the front door, it doesn't trigger anything else. So what we agree on is what they have to do. They've made their good faith effort. And we always get some kind of improved access, if it's only a doorbell to let people know, okay, I can't get up the eight steps, and also we can't fix the eight steps, but we know you're here, and we'll come to you. That's the simplest. There are other ways, automatic door openers when there's no side strike. There are many other ways that people can do something less than the code would prefer. Interestingly, we're not bound by the code. When we make an agreement, that's our agreement. So we can be a little bit creative. And nobody has, the only appeal after us is a court case, and nobody's ever challenged one of our decisions.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
My name's Artie Lerner. I'm also member of the Access Appeals Commission. I'm an architect. The words that I haven't heard anybody say at all is what Walter was just referring to in terms of when there was steps and somebody had a doorbell. And the words are curbside service. If you go to the Justice Department's website about the ADA, you'll find that they have a number of publications that they have put together just for small businesses. And one of the things they talk about is something called curbside service, something that I've used a number of times. A restaurant's up on the second floor. There was a frozen yogurt place on Market Street that had a step, and we weren't going to change all of Market Street. So we put in that doorbell, and we put in a little so they could then ring somebody to come out and take their order and give them that ice cream on the sidewalk. There are all kinds of alternatives. In terms of the unreasonable hardship, Regina Dick Andrizzi, who was the director of the Office of Small Business back in 2018, produced this paper about dealing with unreasonable hardships that I'd like to give to you so that maybe you can make copies, because I think some really smart things in here that she talked about that could help the department in terms of dealing with that. So anyway, I just wanted to throw those two things out there.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jerry Drentler. I'd like to talk about meeting disclosure. So if you go to the DBI and you Google DBI meeting calendar for December, it's blank. So that's not acceptable.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Not sure about that item, but just to clarify that our meetings are publicly noticed and on the website and available. But I'll look into that issue.
Sure, we're in compliance. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We are on to the next item, item 5, update regarding the status of current Technical Services Division or TSD programs.
Hello again, Mary Wilkinson Church, Department of Building Inspection. So I'm here today to provide a quick update on our compliance programs that are part of our Technical Services Division. So DBI compliance programs, they have been amended into the building code by the Board of Supervisors and the mayor. They are administered by Permit Services Technical Services Division. Currently, we have the Soft Story Program, Accessible Business Entrance Program, Facade Inspection and Maintenance Program, and we also have the BORP Program. Additionally, in the future, we foresee having the Concrete Building Seismic Evaluation Program. So for the soft story program, this requires the seismic retrofitting of all wood frame structures with 5 or more residential units, having 2 or more stories over a soft story and permitted for construction prior to 1978. So the final deadline for this program is September 15th of 21. So, you know, we have surpassed the deadline. We've had good compliance in the program. We've had 4,941 buildings in this program for a total completion rate for the compliance process. We've met a completion rate of 94%, and that is 4,648 buildings that have complied. 293 buildings, or 6% of the total buildings, are out of compliance. So 30 of those have not applied for a permit. 44 have applied for a permit but have yet to obtain that permit. 174 have been issued a permit but have not completed the work that's part of that retrofit. And then we have 45 that have not completed their certificate of final completion yet. So they've completed the work, but they have not gotten to the point where they've been able to actually close the permit. So for the next program, the Accessible Business Entrance Program, we've had some discussion about that already today. The final deadline for that program is September 29th of 25. In this program, we have 23,533 buildings, 19,596 buildings, or 83% of the buildings, have started or completed the compliance process. 3,937 buildings, or 17%, we have not received response. And then 958 buildings, or 4% exceptions, have been requested. So 554 buildings, technical infeasibility. So there's actually a structural limitation that creates the noncompliance issue. 378 have requested on the checklist a financial hardship, but have not necessarily applied for a permit to go through the steps for the appeal. And then 26 qualified for both the technical infeasibility or and a financial hardship. And in that case, the technical infeasibility would prevent the need for appeal. The facade inspection and maintenance program is, it requires the exterior of all buildings that are five or more stories tall to be regularly inspected by a California licensed architect or engineer. The reporting deadlines are staggered, and they are between 12/31 of 21 and 12/31 of 32, and there are ongoing requirements for that program. 1,791 buildings in the comprehensive program of five stories or more, 328 started or completed comprehensive compliance process. That's an overall percentage of 18%. 1,548 or 82%, the deadline has not passed, or they are not out of compliance for their comprehensive program. 255 buildings are also in the supplemental program. This program includes buildings that are 15 stories or more. 38 or 15% started or completed the supplemental compliance process. And then 217 or 85%, the deadline has not passed, or they are not out of compliance for their supplemental program. So for the future, what we foresee coming down the pike, and we have been working as a team with the Department of I just lost the name of the department, but we have been working with the Department of the department that is working on the earthquake program directly. I will think of it. Correct. Yes. Yes. Thank you so much. Sorry about that. So we've been working, DBI has been working with the Office of Resiliency through the earthquake program screening. And Mayor Breed has issued an executive directive to draft legislation mandating screening of concrete buildings for seismic vulnerabilities and to publish retrofit standards in the San Francisco Building Code. So the deadline for this was 10/16/24. Drafts are completed for both the standards and also the draft for the legislation. These two drafts are pending introduction to the Board of Supervisors, and we foresee that will be introduced in the new year, and then the screening portion of the program will go into effect most likely in summer of 2025.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll call for public comment, and then the commissioners will do their question and answer. Thank you. So is there public comment on item five? Is there any remotely? Seeing none, did commissioners have any questions on this or comments on this item?
I do.
of Ms. Church? Or?
Yes, yes, please.
You can come back up, Mary.
I was curious. So, how does your division refer out of compliant buildings that are non-compliant? Do you refer them to code enforcement, or how does enforcement work? Is that performed within your division, or does that get referred out to inspectors?
So it is referred to code enforcement when a building is established to be out of compliance. Actually, we've been working directly with code enforcement on a way to make some alterations to our existing permitting system where we can actually flag code enforcement when that happens. So we've been making some MIS changes in our existing permitting system, and we've been working with Mauricio from code enforcement, and we're getting there, and we hope to actually see that in place by January, but it's going to be really helpful because it will be, rather than sort of, a referral via an Excel spreadsheet, it will be something that automatically flags the inspectors, and they can see the compliance history on the building before they go out into the field to perform their inspections.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah. Do you happen to know how many notices of violation have been issued on any of these divisions or any of these programs?
Let me see. Let me have that information.
If you don't, we can maybe get that through the director at a later time.
Yeah, we can get that for you for sure.
Yeah.
I can get that information to you. I'm not sure that I did bring it with me today.
No problem.
Okay.
I have a question for you as well. I was wondering if there's some kind of balcony inspection and maintenance program. Because I feel like a lot of times I'm just thinking of that accident that happened in Berkeley. I think it was semi-recently. And so because of that accident, I know Berkeley started I don't know what the status is, but I think they're starting like a balcony maintenance program, and it seems like for balconies, these happen sort of after a tragedy happens. And so I'm wondering if maybe as part of the facade inspection, there should be an offshoot to balconies. I don't know if this is the proper forum to talk about this, but just hearing you speak about the facade inspection made me think about balconies as part of that. Yeah.
A new piece of legislation.
So we can have Matt Green address that one.
Thank
for you.
So there's in the San Francisco Housing Code, there's an existing requirement that every 5 years the appendages of a residential building is supposed to be inspected, and they submit a report to the department. There's also some state law requirements that we're trying to wrap into that housing code requirement. But I could prepare a more detailed report for that if you want in a future meeting. Thank you.
Any further question or comments?
I had one more question. I don't know which of these this microphone.
I think it's you.
Okay. Well, if you can hear me, that's all that matters. We just had this conversation about the appeals and how I'm curious about how materials get sent out about compliance for these programs. Are people aware of appeals processes? Is there an appeals process for each of these programs? And just if you could speak a little bit to that, especially with some of these programs already, their compliance dates have passed. So wondering, like, have people appealed? How do we get that last percentage into compliance?
Okay, so you're asking about all the programs, whether or not there's an appeal process for each program?
Yes.
Okay, so we do have our Department of Building Inspection appeals that we use as our general format or platform for appeals. The Access Appeals Commission is a specific commission that was, developed as part of the development of the ABE program, and their appeal process is specific to accessibility appeals.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Can I, somewhat along that lines, could you talk about the process for the exemptions requested? You said, is there an internal process for granting exemptions? for technical infeasibility or financial hardship? And could you talk about that?
So financial hardship would be the unreasonable hardship. And the building code does not really speak to unreasonable hardship. The building code has specific expectations for accessibility. But of course, the building code requires accessibility to come along with the improvement of a building over time. So the ABE program is actually sort of, it's part of our San Francisco building code, but it's not part of the state building code, and it's not a requirement of state building code that if, you know, a building is not being improved, that they're required to bring the building into compliance with accessibility. So the Access Appeals Commission does hear the unreasonable hardship requests. However, there is building code criteria for establishing a technical infeasibility. So technical infeasibilities are actually determined within the department as part of the plan review process.
Thank you. And we heard, do you know, and if you don't have it with you, that's fine, but we saw through public comment that approximately 2/3 of the 83% that are in compliance were either waived or sought to be exempt. Do you know? Can you verify that, or do you have any information to collaborate?
I would have to confirm that. Take a look at the data.
Yeah, that'd be helpful if we can get that to the director. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you so much. I have no further questions. Anybody else? Thank you so much for your presentations.
Okay. Thank you. Our next item is item 6, Director's Report, 6A, Director's Update.
President Alexander Tews and the other commissioners who joined us this morning for our all hands, both remotely and in person. Twice a year, we get all our staff together for an hour to acknowledge new and long tenured employees, discuss changes at the department, provide updates on our strategic plan, and share data on how we are performing. So many of our employees are in the field or working directly with customers that these meetings are really our chance to get together, learn about each other's work, and really understand the impact of the improvements that we're making. For your support and dedication to our department and to the city. Your willingness to dedicate your time, energy, and intelligence to overseeing DBI is welcome and appreciated. From your tough questions to your thoughtful discussions to your ongoing support for our efforts to improve the department, you push us to be better, and for that we're deeply grateful. Thank you. Happy holidays from all of us at DBI. We look forward to working with you in the new year. And that almost concludes my report, because I just wanted to mention ORCP is the Office of Resilience and Capital Planning. It's a cross-departmental agency that focuses on resilience in the both infrastructure and in housing in the city. So just, I'm sure you're aware of that, but I just thought I'd mention it. So that does conclude my report.
Okay, thank you. Next is item 6B, update on major projects. It's showing here. SF Gov, can we get that? Okay. Oh, thank you. There it is.
Good morning again, commissioners. The following slides are intended to highlight the volume and valuation of projects costing $5 million or more that have been filed, issued, or completed in the past month. We will profile a few projects that bring especially high value in terms of their contribution to both housing and community assets. In November of 2024, 7 permit applications with an estimated construction value of $5 million or more were filed with DBI. One application was for a new 3-story office building for the new Southeast treatment plant at 750 Phelps Street. That was valued at $75 million. Another was for the new Carpenters Union Hall at 3433 3rd Street. That was valued at $15.6 million. Last month, we issued one high-value permit. It was for the conversion of the Hearst Building at 5 3rd Street to a hotel. The valuation of that project is $53.3 million. And lastly, DBI finaled 2 high-value permits. One was for a medical office tenant improvement at 1635 Divisadero Street, which was valued at $8.9 million. And the other was for a new preschool facility at 333 Dolores Street. That was valued at $7.5 million. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have item 6C, update on proposed or recently enacted state or local legislation.
Thank you. Morning, President Alexander Tutin, commission members. Tate Hanna, Legislative Affairs Manager. Should be a relatively quick update given the legislative session is wrapping up and folks are getting out for the new year, but we can run through next slide, please. File number 241005. This is an ordinance adopting Chapter 6 through 11 of the 2022 California Existing Building Code. We are not planning any amendments for that adoption. It is being reviewed by the Code Advisory Committee. They've seen this twice now, but are asking for additional time, and so we're willing to grant that, have it go through the subcommittees before it reaches you all for additional review. Next slide, please. Next is file number 240982. This is an ordinance amending the Building, Administrative, and Public Works Codes to remove the local requirement for existing buildings with a place of public accommodation to have all primary entries and paths of travel into the building accessible to persons with disabilities or to receive a city determination of equivalent facilitation, technical infeasibility, or unreasonable hardship. This is the ABE reform ordinance that we've been discussing that you all reviewed back on November 20th. Next slide, please. And the last local ordinance is file number 241067. This is an ordinance allowing interim housing in hotels and motels without requiring a change of use or use classification. This was also reviewed by you all and approved unanimously on November 20th. Next slide, please. And then the state legislative calendar on January 1, unless otherwise indicated within a law, those statutes will take effect. January 6, the legislature will reconvene. January 10, the budget must be submitted by the governor, the first draft of his budget. And then by February 21, bills will be introduced. And so we should have a good understanding of what's going to be pending before us. Obviously, bills can be gut and amended, and so we'll have new things throughout the legislative cycle, but we'll have a general understanding by February 21. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next is item 6D, update on inspection services.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Matthew Green, Deputy Director for Inspection Services. I'm pleased to provide an update of the activities performance of the Inspection Services Division for November. Next slide, please. In November of 2024, the Building, Electrical, and Plumbing Divisions conducted 9,254 inspections. 91% of these inspections were conducted within 2 business days of the date requested by the customer, meeting our target of 90%. Next slide. In the same month, our Housing Inspection Services conducted 702 inspections, with 58 of them being the routine inspections of residential apartment buildings. Sorry. Next slide. The Building, Electrical, and Plumbing Divisions received 415 complaints. Additionally, our Code Enforcement Division sent 102 cases onto directors' hearings. Lastly, our Housing Inspection Services received 333 non-life hazard complaints and responded to 88% of them within 3 business days. For life hazard and heat complaints, Housing received 44 complaints and responded to 84% of those within 1 business day. Housing Inspection Services was also able to abate 266 cases with a notice of violation and sent 22 additional cases on to director's hearing. That concludes my report. I'm available for any questions you may have. No. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have 6E, update on DBI's finances.
Good morning, Commissioners. Alex Koskinen, Deputy Director, Administration. This month, I have a regular financial update, some news about the budget, and some other programmatic news to share with you. So we're 5 months of the way through the year. We will make projections in January for 6 months, and then again at 9 months. Next slide, please. November was not our greatest month financially. It was a bit slower. Hopefully that is just slow winter time and it picks up, especially compared to last year. There was one very large project last year, so comparatively this November does not look great, but we're still on track to come in on budget by the end of the year. Next slide, please. Expenditures, it's still early, but we're tracking at or below budget for expenditures. Next slide, please. And again, as previously mentioned, this November was not great. We're still at the same number of permits for the same time period, the first 5 months of the year, as compared to last year. However, the valuation is now lower, again, due to one very large project. Next slide, please. So I mentioned last meeting, and I'll mention again now, I'm very interested to hear feedback from all commissioners on what they would like to see for next month's budget presentations, what information they're hoping to see in order to make informed decisions in the upcoming vote on whether to send the approved budget to the board and the mayor. Mayor's budget office has just released budget instructions for the next fiscal year. The main point in their presentation was that they are projecting a $1.5 billion deficit over the next 5 years. And that is higher than I have seen in the past. They always project deficits and then lower expenditures to get that under control, but things seem a bit worse because the projection or the deficit is caused at least partially by lower revenue estimates. They're not projecting an overall deficit or a recession in the economy, but they're cautioning that recovery remains slow in San Francisco, and so the general fund will not be there to bail programs out. So they have given instructions to all departments citywide that they want to see a 15% reduction to all general fund supported expenditures, and the CBO that applies to DBI's CBO grants, which are DBI's only general fund supported expenditures. So we were given the amount that will be in the department's budget submission. That's the $3.672 million, down from the $4.32 as approved last year. There is a lot of uncertainty with the budget overall. We have a new mayor, a new administration coming in, so it remains to be seen what the new administration will do, what changes they will make in the mayor's budget office, what their priorities will be. So we have, I think the whole city is in a general holding pattern. They've been told make these reductions for now, and then we will have new conversations in the mayor's phase of the budget with the new administration. And also recently, after this presentation was developed, we learned some news about one of the CBOs that I'd like to share, Casa Justa Just Cause. One of the smaller CEOP program CBOs has let us know that they will close permanently and cease operations very soon, December 20th. So we're meeting with them to determine what that means, what the impacts are. Are they shutting down all services, or exactly what that means for the services they provide, and exploring options for how to how to ensure that the service continues to be provided. And that's it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
One for me. Just one, Alex. Oh, sorry. Thank you. Just one, Alex. It's the same question I think we keep asking. We, as a commission, can't change the budget. We so can recommend. We can recommend or pass it with recommendations, but we can't change any light items. We can't say, Alex, go back to the board and like change those numbers, move that over there. We can't do any of that, or can we?
Thank you for bringing that up. And sorry, I was going to mention, thank you very much, Vice President Shaddix, for your questions that you sent in. Hopefully you received the responses. Correct. The commission cannot make line item changes to the budget. The commission interacts with the department through the department head. So the commission would send a request to Director O'Riordan through the commission secretary with its priorities and wishes and potential changes to the budget. And to get into some of the other questions that you had asked, the department is one of the earlier phases of the budget. After the department submits its budget, it goes to the mayor's office who makes changes. They will submit mayor's proposed budget on June 1st. They can make any changes they want. After that, then the supervisors take over and they can make limited changes. They can't change anything. They can't increase the overall size of the budget, but they make their changes and then it's passed by the full board and signed by the mayor again. So that's the order of operations. It doesn't come back to, the budget does not come back to the BIC after the department submission is made in February.
Okay, thank you.
I think you actually answered my question. I was gonna ask timing and phases of this, but it sounds like we make our recommendations in February and then it kind of goes off into other hands from there. We don't know until after June what the final decisions are.
Correct, final budget, final decisions are made in July and then the mayor officially signs around August 1st.
Thank you. So commissioners, please, if you want to see things as part of Alex's budget presentation, please make those requests through the secretary so that he can be sure to include those as part of his budget presentation and some of the background materials.
Thank you. So is there any public comment on the director's report items 6A through E?
There is. I have a handout. Thank you. Okay, I'm ready. Thank you for waiting. This slide is from my November 2024 BIC presentation of Inspector Mark Wall's 95 Orange Alley condo project, and it deals with the 30 suppressed complaints. I sent DBI a request for copies of the 30 suppressed complaints. When I didn't get them, I followed up with Director O'Riordan, who instructed the Sunshine team to deal with my request. They told me they don't have the complaints. They say the complaints are test files. But if you look at the first page, you know, they have condo numbers on them. Doesn't make any sense. 2 days ago, I asked DBI to send me the 30 test file documents. And they told me they were double checking. Yesterday, they told me they have no responsive documents in PTS. But if you see on the right side of the screen, I called up one of those documents. So there are 30 documents in PTS complaints with complaint numbers. So that's not true. I mean, this is nonsense. This is like total freaking nonsense. And it needs to stop. I have one more thing I'd like to show you. And that is, this is the, if you could turn the computer on, this is the DBI meeting calendar for December 2024. Very useful. Not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional public comment in person or remotely? Seeing none, item 7, commissioners' questions and matters. 7A, inquiries to staff. At this time, commissioners may make inquiries to staff regarding various documents, policies, practices, and procedures which are of interest to the commission. And 7B, future meeting and agendas. At this time, the commission may discuss and take action to set the date of a special meeting and or determine those items that could be placed on the agenda of the next meeting and other future meetings of the Building Inspection Commission. The next regular meeting will be on January 15th, 2025. And are there any inquiries to staff or future items for the January meeting?
Oh, January 15th, okay.
Okay, thank you. And then all of you can reach out to me if you'd like.
I'm just going to make a quick comment about.
Okay, go ahead and speak.
Just an update. I met with Matt Green to talk about our backlog on AAB. So just keep an eye out for 2025. We might be having a few extra AAB meetings to get through that backlog. There's been a lot of other work done to address permits that are moving forward and trying to reduce the number of cases that we have to hear. But we just simply cannot get through all of them if we maintain our current cadence. So we'll have a few extra meetings next year, and we'll be reaching out about time that works.
Okay, thank you. Okay, is there any public comment on 7A and B? Seeing none, item 8, review and approval of the minutes of the regular meeting of November 20th, 2024.
So moved.
There's a motion by President Alexander Toot. Is there a second?
Second.
And a second by Commissioner Williams. Is there any public comment on the minutes? Seeing none, are all commissioners in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Then the motion carries unanimously. Thank you. And next, item 9, adjournment. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
And there a second? Second. All commissioners in favor?
Aye. Aye.
We are now adjourned. It is 11:27 a.m. And happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays.